ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Selamat pagi, Laura. How's your Bahasa Indonesia?
Oh, it's mortifyingly, embarrassingly non-existent, Hamish.
Well, look, you're not alone, Laura. Australia has long been trying to strengthen our ties and connections with the region.
And yet kids in school are taught very little about our largest neighbour.
So what needs to change?
I'm Laura Tingle.
I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's go roaming. Laura Tingle, how sick and tired are you of hearing Australia have a conversation about how we need to turn our attention to Asia and really engage with the region in which we sit?
Oh, look, I'm not sick and tired of it, Hamish, but it sort of feels like it's a bit of a groundhog day. It's one of those issues that keeps coming up. If you cover federal politics long enough, it just, you know, we're having this one again,
yeah.
Which is fine. We should be having these discussions. The question is, do we never move on from that? Are we always going back to the same spot, or are we going somewhere different?
And I suppose the reason we're having the conversation right now is because not only are we not going forward with those conversations, we seem to be going backwards. Can I give you a couple of figures?
Please.
So domestic enrolments in Southeast Asian languages at our universities have fallen 75%. Since 2005.
Staggering.
Of the 1 million domestic Australian uni students, barely 500 of them are studying Indonesian languages at the moment. Year 12 Indo students across Australia fell from just over 1,100 in 2010 to 486 in 2024.
I mean, it's both staggering and really shocking. I mean, you would think that it had just become endemic in the Australian school system that we would be getting better language skills. If not for anything else, then we've got this massive Southeast Asian diaspora now. But I started my career in the 80s when suddenly we were looking out to the world and Paul Keating was pushing us to get into Asia, and we've had all those waves of it since. But it doesn't feel on a day-to-day level like we're very conscious of what's going on.
I know I've been harping on about it because we did a whole Indonesia mini-series on global roaming, but concurrently, the Parliament of Australia has been running an inquiry that's been looking into building Australia's capability, and it's heard some really interesting evidence and voices. And I guess just the one piece of context that I want to inject into this before we start the conversation with Tim Watts, who's the MP that's led that inquiry, is that, and we've said it plenty of times before, Indonesia's on track, we think, to become fourth or fifth largest economy in the world by the middle of the century. This isn't a poorer neighbour anymore. This is a fast-growing, dynamic, tech-savvy nation that, along with that economic growth, is looking to project power in the region and in the world in a much more sophisticated way. And that's going to mean that we have a different relationship with them as well, whether we like it or not. Tim Watts is the guy that's led this inquiry. He's a Labor MP. He's the committee chair at the House of Representatives inquiry into building Asia capability in Australia. Hey, Tim, welcome back to Global Roaming.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you.
So listen, there's one standout warning in your report that without intervention, Indonesian language teaching will be functionally extinct in Australia by 2031. That's pretty stark. How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this should be a shock to the Australian political system. Makassar sea traders were coming to the Northern Territory and speaking Malay Indonesian with the Yolngu people for hundreds of years. So it would be a cruel irony if the teaching of the language went extinct today, at the moment when the relationship is more important than ever. My view is that if, as we often say, there's no country more important to Australia than Indonesia, then as a result, it should also follow that there's no country that's more important to understand than Indonesia. Regrettably, though, that hasn't flowed through to our education system.
One of the things that I thought was great about the report, but also your tabling speech and, you know, when we've talked about it, is, you know, just bringing to life the real-world implications of that. Maybe outline for people what the flow-on implications are for the relationship if you can't speak the language, just in a day-to-day sense.
Well, I mean, I used a number of examples in the tabling speech of Australian diplomats in the region who have been able to use these language skills in the relationship. You know, it's really fundamental to building a relationship of trust and understanding to be able to speak the language. We talk a lot about AI these days, and AI will make that symbolic translation cheaper and easier to access. But it can't give you the meaning. It can't give you the depth of knowledge and understanding about what's happening in a relationship. So if we want to push the relationship to a deeper level, if we want to do investment beyond the border, if we want to do trade in services like education, like healthcare, you know, we need that deeper level of understanding in order to be effective in country.
Tim, your report rightly is warning us as a nation of what's at risk. But actually, what struck me listening to and watching a lot of the hearings was the sort of optimism and opportunity that people were talking to you about, like what is available to us. And I think what we've been grappling with for a while on global roaming is the opportunity that's being presented to Australia in this complex global moment of Indonesia's rise and Southeast Asia's rise. We tend to be, if I may offer, a fairly opportunistic nation. Why aren't we grabbing this opportunity?
I I've reflected on that as well. And I agree with you. There is so much opportunity here. When we talk about our region becoming more complex and more consequential, that's not just downside. You know, when we look at the Moore report, you know, this Australia, Southeast Asia economic strategy, it shows that, you know, Southeast Asia is one of the biggest growth areas in the world. And as a neighbour, we have enormous opportunity to take advantage of that. You know, Australia, our education system has been stubbornly monolingual for a long time. That's like an institutional bias that we've had. So, you know, we really haven't been able to cut through that in the past.
And I suppose being a little bit longer in the tooth than either of you, I mean, like, it feels like this conversation has sort of dominated most of my lifespan. I mean, when I was at school, they were teaching Bahasa.
Yeah.
But dare one say, Paul Keating was talking about, you know, engaging with Asia, you know, not flying over it and all those sorts of things. And,
yeah,
and you know, in the great deregulatory sort of expansion into the world that happened as a result of the floating of the dollar and us looking outwards and all those sorts of things, everybody was saying there's got to be these opportunities, and we just don't seem to ever be able to land it. But, you know, if you go to the region, everybody's really fascinated by what we're doing.
But come on, Tingle, you've been covering Australian politics for probably most of my lifetime, to be fair, or a big chunk of it.
Most of my life.
Why do you reckon we keep talking about it but don't really do it?
Oh, look, I think let's cut to it. Sometimes these markets are hard. They're different economies. We're not very good at dealing with them. I think there was a lot of companies that went in with their ears pinned back and got burnt because they just didn't have that sort of level of experience. And I think it was also just because of the nature of our economy. And I mean, if you look at the big relationships between Australia and places like Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, they're basically very heavily, you know, food in one direction, resources in the other, to put it really bluntly. And they aren't necessarily things that engage a lot of person-to-person, you know, business stuff.
We're a bit extractive, maybe.
We're a bit extractive, but, you know, and they take food from us, you know, but it doesn't, it's sort of all big-ticket items. I mean, Tim, you've been listening to everybody talking about this. Are we wrong? Is there something we're missing here?
No, look, I completely agree. I mean, if you look at the nature of our economic engagement in the region over previous decades, it has been largely commodities driven, you know, backing up big ship at the border, delivering a cargo. You know, one of the messages that came from this inquiry is that the future decades will demand more of Australian leaders and Australian institutions. As I said earlier, if we want to push into, you know, investment beyond the border, and if we want to push into trade in services, we're going to need to understand, you know, the burgeoning middle class and upper classes of Asia in order to be able to deliver those services and to make those investments in the region. You know, we are uniquely ill-suited as an education system to do this, though, because, you know, building Asia capability takes long-term focus and national coordination across the Federation. They're both things that have been hard for Australia to do.
So tease that out then. What would you like to see happen? How are you creating a long-term focus across state and federal to deliver on this stuff?
Well, I mean, one thing that's different about this report compared to all of the previous reports on Asia capability we've had going back decades now is that those reports, you know, were about the future. This report is about the moment now. So, you know, we are really on a burning platform at the moment, and the consequences of generations of governments kicking the can down the road in our education system means that the current government is currently facing the bill. You know, we are confronting that immediate reality of Indonesian studies going extinct in the next term of the parliament. You know, this is not a future consideration. If we want to do something about this, it really requires a commitment to making a choice, viewing Asia capability as an important sovereign capability and providing national leadership and planning to deliver it. What do I mean by that? I mean, you look at our school system at the moment, we have 10 bilingual Chinese schools in Australia, primary schools. Only 5 of them are within the catchment zone of a high school that enables those kids to continue on that Mandarin study at all. And at all of those high schools, the kids have to start from scratch again at Nihao. There's no coordination of the pipeline so that we can have a continuous progression of learning across primary, secondary, university into the workplace, and that requires national coordination.
Well, I mean, one of the really powerful examples you gave of what this means, in reality, was about our current Indonesian ambassador and the fact that, you know, he studied Bahasa, you know, he went and lived in Indonesia and is a fluent speaker of the language. But I get the sense that there isn't a cohort of people coming up behind him, even in the Department of Foreign Affairs, who are fluent speakers. And it's not just about speaking the language, of course. I mean, it's like it is about knowing the history of the country in a really deep way, so that if something happens in Indonesia, you've got people who can say, well, Prime Minister, you know, I know that, you know, I know who this guy is, I know who this guy is. You know, I mean, just at the level of government, it's so crucial.
And I'd just throw in on that before you respond, Tim, that when we spoke to Rod Brazier, who's the ambassador you're talking about on this program, something that emerged that I learned not from him but from others in Jakarta was that there's very few foreign missions in Jakarta where the bulk of the staff speak fluent Bahasa. And so when they turn up for the meetings, whether they're bilaterals or multilateral meetings, Australia actually has this incredible advantage by being able to engage. And Rod Brazier, the ambassador, does all of his engagements, both public and private, in Bahasa. And so just to your question earlier, Laura, about what difference does it make, I think that's a very tangible example. So, Tim, take it away.
Look, Hamish, you've really gotten to the nub of a seeming contradiction at the heart of this inquiry, and that's that, you know, the current moment, I think, the Australian government's statecraft in Asia has been more active and more effective than ever before. You know, we are more ambitious and we're doing more in the region than any previous government. So why am I saying that there's an Asia capability crisis? Well, because the people that are delivering that agenda are the products of investments made in our Asia capability in our education system generations before, investments we're not making today. Rod's a great example of that. You know, he's a product of high school Indonesian language programs. He's a product of Asian studies at Griffith University. He's the product of in-country study at the university. And you look at all of the rungs of the ladder that he's climbed to develop the capability he has, and they're all under severe strain at the moment.
But in researching this, Tim, we found that actually the Education Department, the Commonwealth Education Department, was asked questions about this very topic. And the answer is, on language, they're agnostic. They don't have a position. So that's also your government, by the way.
Well,
like, why on earth doesn't the Commonwealth Education Department have a position on that says it's in our national interest. This is the part of the world we live in. And yes, we do it with STEM, for example, trying to get particularly young women into STEM. There's all sorts of areas in which we do try and, I guess, manipulate is a less benign word, but we do.
And it's been done in the past. I mean, Kevin Rudd, of course, was a great advocate for language training in schools back in his day. And, you know, there've been other surges of it. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, we should be clear that the situation we find ourselves in today is the product of decisions of governments going back decades. You know, this is not a new problem or a newly emerging problem. And if you look on paper, Asia should be a priority in our education system. So in the national curriculum, for example, there are a series of cross-curriculum priorities that are supposed to embed the study of Asia across the system. The problem is in the translation of, you know, on-paper commitments to in-classroom teaching. And that requires, as I said before, you know, real coordination throughout the system. Now, there are something like 30 recommendations in the report that we tabled. It's unusual for a parliamentary report in that respect. It's tried to be comprehensive in saying, here's how to build a sustainable pipeline to build capability. You know, in the past, those reports that we've talked about earlier, you know, including the Australian the Asian Century White Paper, the Garnaut Report, the Varghese Report, the Rudd Report, the Wesley Report, you know, they've tried to sort of build breadth, but maybe shallow breadth throughout the education system. You know, everyone gets a bit of Asia. What we're saying in this report is that the current moment is asking more, and it's asking us to build a pipeline of deep capability to enable Australians to develop their Asia capabilities throughout their education and their professional career.
And we've talked mainly about Indonesia here, Tim, but you did reference Chinese as well earlier on. I mean, do you think it's one of those things where we've got to say, okay, we need deep capability and we particularly need them in Indonesia and we need them in China. We'll get by in Japan. I mean, where would the priorities be for you?
Well, one of the interesting things in this inquiry is that there were very different supply and demand factors affecting each of the different language groups. So if you look at Chinese studies, for example, you know, there is a strong diaspora demand to learn Mandarin Chinese. Much of that demand, I should say, is being met by weekend schools, community schools, rather than our formal education system. But it is being propped up in some respect for that. What's not happening to the same extent, though, is the study of China. Now, you know, the Australian government's mantra on China is now well known. You know, we cooperate where we can, disagree where we must, but always engage in the national interest. Now, the National Foundation for Australia-China Relations has said that that implies a risk-informed engagement strategy. So we've got to understand what those risks are when we're engaging. That requires a deep knowledge of China across all the dimensions of the PRC, the party, the economy, society, culture, all of the full gamut requires deep language capabilities. And the foundation said that in their view, Australia's China capability was substantially below what we needed in order to effectively pursue that strategy.
You're listening to Global Roaming with Hamish McDonald and Laura Tingle. We're speaking to Federal Labor MP Tim Watts, the Special Envoy for Indian Ocean Affairs. He's talking about why we need to prioritise Indonesia, not just in our trade or security, but in our schools. So, Tim, this is happening at quite a transformative time for Indonesia. Prabowo Subianto taking a lot of these direct interventions in the economy in the first couple of years he was in office. There have been a few mixed results on that. Things like the school food program, which has cost billions and billions of dollars, but also much greater state intervention in the economy. Does it make it harder to engage with Indonesia as a trading partner at a time of such change? I mean, what are the implications there?
Well, look, what I'd say is that the trajectory of Australia's economic relationship with Indonesia is moving in the right direction. You know, I would like it to be accelerated. I'd like it to be greater. But if you compare where we are now to where we were, you know, before we signed the trade architecture with Indonesia, it's moving in a positive direction. And I see, you know, Australian companies building hospitals in Indonesia, Australian universities, a number of them opening campuses in Indonesia. You know, these are initiatives that are pushing the economic relationship into realms that we haven't had before. So it is happening, but, you know, you've got to view this over the long arc, I think. You know, Australia and Indonesia are neighbours by geography, but we're partners by choice. So we've got to keep making that decision to commit to building that relationship over time.
But Tim, there is a wider context here, and a listener called Bruce Ricketts has written in with a question. He's a PhD student at Swinburne studying the Indonesia-Australia relationship in the AUKUS era. Bruce raises the question of whether there's a growing perception in Indonesia and the wider region that Australia is just acting as a proxy for US power. How do you deal with that perception? Because clearly it exists and, you know, the US isn't really popular anywhere in the world right now, but particularly so in this region.
Yeah, Hamish, look, to be frank, I find that's a perception that exists more in Australia than it does in the region. I hear that more from Australians than I do when I'm moving through the region. You know, Australia, we have built a reputation for engagement in Southeast Asia that is one that is based on a really strong commitment to building a region that preserves agency and sovereignty for all countries, including middle powers. You know, like our rhetoric in the region is we want a region where no country dominates and no country is dominated. And that when we talk about our commitment to building a regional balance, it is in order to provide space for countries to make their own choices.
I'm just not sure that the end detail there, I'm not sure that particularly lands in Southeast Asia. I reckon that's where that argument falls down a bit, because Southeast Asia does tend to be far more pragmatic about US-China great power plays.
I mean, look, Hamish, I think just look at the evidence. I mean, we are a sought-after partner in the region. You know, we've just upgraded our security relationship with Indonesia through the Treaty on Common Security. You know, we are doing more on a defence and security basis with Singapore than ever before. We've just upgraded our diplomatic relationships with Vietnam to a comprehensive strategic partnership. Across the board, our diplomatic security and defence relationships are becoming deeper in recent times. So I think the evidence is there.
I just wonder, though, when and if these new arrangements with the United States come to pass, I wonder if that does start to change the conversation that we're having in our region. Like, we're not really even having the conversation properly in Australia about it. Like, there's not been much of a debate. These are just things that have been agreed to. Mm. And, you know, there is a way of looking at it. I'm sure you'll disagree with this, but there is a way of looking at it that under these arrangements, Australia is effectively just becoming a big naval base.
Particularly a big air base with B-52s that can carry nuclear warheads based in the Northern Territory, which quite a lot of people don't know, is already happening. You've got that happening, but, you know, we saw a couple of weeks ago China tested a ballistic missile in the Pacific. Everybody got quite agitated about that, both here and in the Pacific. Shouldn't that agitation reflect back on us? After all, we act as one of the largest aircraft carriers for the United States in the region.
Look, pivoting from Southeast Asia to the Pacific there, PIF leaders have made clear that they want the Pacific to be a peaceful region. You know, that Ocean of Peace policy has come through the Pacific Islands Forum. We've said that we view that the Chinese missile testing as being contrary to that, it being destabilising, running contrary to the objective of having a region of peace. And I think Pacific Island leaders' response to that, you know, really underlines that view, because we should be clear that that ballistic missile test happens in the context of China's military buildup. You know, it's a rapid buildup that's taking place without the transparency and the reassurance that the region expects. Now, when we talk about things like AUKUS...
But do you think conversely there is the transparency around what Australia's allowing the United States to do here?
Absolutely. We are both transparent about what we are doing and also provide strategic reassurance about why we are doing it with our partners in the region.
Okay, so why do we have US B-52 bombers flying over our skies?
What we said is for our defence policy, our partnerships with security partners, the investments that we are making in our defence capabilities, we are doing that in order to build a regional balance that preserves sovereignty and agency for countries in the region. You know, if, as I said earlier, there is a very significant military buildup occurring in our region, if that happens without a response from other countries, that's inherently destabilising in itself.
So this stuff is a response to that. You're as explicit as that.
In the Pacific, we've said that we understand that we are in a permanent contest. You know, we are clear-eyed, realistic about China's objectives and the implications of its objectives for the regional balance of power. That's a realism that we bring to that analysis in how we engage with China, how we build our own resilience, and how we strengthen our partnerships across the region.
So do you think that on that basis, you're sort of saying that some of our regional neighbours would actually get some reassurance from the fact that Australia's got a capability when it comes to, you know, keeping freedom of navigation, not just in the South China Sea, but, you know, the Malacca Straits, all around the region closest to us? I mean, is that what you would, your message would be to our closest neighbours?
Well, when we engage with our neighbours, we're saying that Australia's approach to strengthening our security partnerships across the region is designed to build a region that's peaceful, stable, and prosperous. It's also pursued on the basis that when we act jointly, we increase the weight of our voice. You know, we can have a greater impact by acting collectively. And, you know, whether that's in Southeast Asia or particularly in the Pacific, where it's an unprecedented level of cooperation. I mean, the Falipilli Union and Tuvalu, Puk Puk Treaty and PNG, Nakmal Agreement, treaty with Vanuatu just signed, Vuvale with Fiji, and more recently, the broader Ocean Alliance. Yeah, this is a really unprecedented diplomatic agenda, and it's through that principle of acting collectively we can increase the weight of our voices and to pursue the objectives that Pacific Islands Forum leaders have outline themselves.
Hey, Tim, it's always really interesting talking to you. We appreciate you coming back.
Pleasure to join Global Roaming.
That was the Federal MP, Tim Watts, Special Envoy for the Indian Ocean, Chair of the House of Representatives Inquiry into Building Asia Capability in Australia. I know it's a catchy title, Laura, but it's an important conversation for our country.
It is an important conversation, and I suppose I do sort of always wonder, why is it that we don't sort of get this right? But, I mean, one of the things we didn't go into with Tim was that education was supposed to be one of the great bridges. We get masses of numbers of students from the region. We still get a lot of people going to the region to study, but while people used to talk about the Colombo plan having been so important in establishing those links, it doesn't seem to have worked.
I don't know if I totally agree with that, only because I had this experience there earlier this year in Indonesia, where I think for the first time I understood our education system as a soft power tool. I don't think I ever actually grasped that properly. When you travel around Indonesia today, there's this whole cohort of people in the positions of power, not just in Jakarta, like I was in Sumatra, for example, Palembang, not a huge city. All of the people there that are the doctors, that are running the hospitals, that are teaching in the universities, that are in the government administration, the provincial administration, so many of them have been educated in Australian universities, and they have this kind of fondness. They are grateful for the experience. They understand Australia in a way that we don't understand, I think, by and large, Indonesia. And I don't think until recently I've understood what that could be for us in the longer term if we really continue to get this right.
It's an insight into something we are, you know, apparently getting right by, you know, being such a big education exporter.
Yeah.
But it also highlights what we're missing out on because we don't do enough of going to Indonesia or any other country in the region to actually build up that expertise and knowledge and familiarity for ourselves.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe there are simple answers. Like, why not supercharge a scholarship program for Australian students to go and study in Indonesia? Like, let's just do this. Let's throw the money at it. It doesn't need to be huge numbers of people, but let's say 1,000 students a year get that opportunity anywhere in Southeast Asia, for example. Like, I do think the chance is there for the taking. And I actually think the whole situation with the Pacific and rugby league diplomacy has made me recognise that actually we are as a nation capable of jumping on something when we can see the value in it. And maybe it's just about grabbing this opportunity.
Yeah, probably.
global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Thanks to producer Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland, and exec producer Laura McAuliffe. We'll be back tomorrow with more. Laura, bye-bye.
See you, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.